the new book, We Were There, Revelations from the Dallas Doctors Who Attended to JFK on November 22, 1963, chronicles the first-person eyewitness memories of the surgeons and 46 other doctors who were then interns, residents, professors, and students the day the president died in Parkland Hospital in Dallas, Texas, in the emergency room. Twice in 48 hours in a time frame, Parkland Hospital was the center of worldwide attention. It was the temporary seat of government of the United States as well as the state of Texas. Our 35th president died in Trauma Room 1. At that moment, the ascendancy of the 36th president of the United States occurred at Parkland. 2 days later, it was the site of the death of the president's accused assassin. Dr. Alan Childs has put together this new book, which chronicles the perspective of the doctors. Dr. Childs was on the scene at Parkland Memorial Hospital when President John F. Kennedy was brought in. And again, he has put together We Were There, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Joe. I really appreciate your time.
Let us talk first about your role and what you were doing that day.
Well, I was a sophomore medical student, so I had no direct responsibility for taking care of the president, but I was able to see most everything that unfolded there. At the moment, the president was being brought in to the Parkland emergency room. I and my roommate, my medical school roommate, were sitting in the Parkland Hospital library, one floor above the emergency rooms at Parkland. At that moment, we saw someone run in and say something to one of the surgeons who was sitting at the other end of the library, and then the staccato pages over the overhead page system, which is all they had then, began, and these pages, we had never heard anything like them before. It was department chairman report to the emergency room. So we knew something rather terrible had happened, and someone came in and told us that the president had been shot.
How much did you know and did the doctors know when the president, upon arrival, in the sense of I assume you were told because of so many doctors being called to the scene, because it was all hands on deck, that that it was a serious situation.
Yes. And your question is?
No, my question is just that. I assume that by calling you all down there, the specific question being, what information did the doctors have as to the severity of the wound?
They had no information, except that he was coming. The emergency dispatcher had received word that the president had been shot, and the switchboard operator initiated those calls. So when my roommate and I tried to go down to the emergency room, we were caught rather rudely by a state trooper and told to go outside, which we did. There were others of us who were in Trauma Room 1 and saw the whole thing unfold from the start to the finish. Some of them have died, and I've used their words from their oral histories they gave to the Sixth Floor Museum and testimony to the Warren Commission and so on to bring their words to light.
As you put together this book, what did you want to accomplish as far as the remembrances of the physicians who were there on that day?
Well, in a certain way, we were like the patrons of the Ford's Theater when President Lincoln was shot. It was a blood-spattered history that assailed us, and each individual in the reports that I have, which vary in distance from the actual unfolding of the event, some with hands-on with President Kennedy, others standing in the pit outside, and others standing a stricken vigil at the outside of the emergency room. But all of these perspectives have a historical significance, and there are variations in what people saw and heard, which is quite remarkable. The unifying feature of all of this is the awesome feeling of grief that most of us experienced. And I wanted to preserve these memories just as we would like to have had the memories of the persons at the Ford's Theater when President Lincoln was shot. I wanted to preserve these memories, especially since many of the people involved have died, and someone needed to hear the stories of the survivors and bring them together with the stories of those who haven't.
I would think that in a situation like this, I mean, you can plan for a crisis, but nothing like this. How soon and how quickly did it become clear who was in charge, medically speaking?
Well, the first person in charge, of course, was Dr. Jim Carrico. He was the second-year resident who happened to be in the emergency room when they brought the president and Governor Connally in. There was no hesitation in terms of Carrico's actions. They were, the very well-trained trauma surgeons there. It's a very famous trauma center at Parkland. So the actions were immediate, and they began to administer fluids to try to support the blood pressure. Dr. Carrico had presence of mind, quite remarkably, to remember that he had read President Kennedy had Addison's disease, so he gave him an intravenous injection of Solu-Cortef. Other doctors then arrived on the scene, and as the more senior persons arrived, the control of the situation ceded to the more senior doctors. Ultimately, the full professor of neurosurgery there, Kemp Clark, who was the one who made the decision to stop the resuscitation effort.
I was struck by a memorandum that you include in the book that is from C.J. Price, who is an administrator of the Dallas County Hospital District, and he writes this to all employees on November 27th, so just a few days after the president's assassination. And he's writing the obvious of talking about how the president passed the hospital, as did Lee Harvey Oswald, which we'll talk about in a moment. And he writes, in the intervening 48 hours and 31 minutes, Parkland Hospital, Memorial Hospital, had 1, become the temporary seat of the government of the United States, 2, became the temporary seat of the government of the state of Texas, 3, became the site of the death of the 35th president, 4, became the site of the ascendancy of the 36th president, 5, became site of the death of President Kennedy's accused assassin, 6, twice became the center of the attention of the world, 7, continued to function as close to normal pace as a large charity hospital. The next paragraph, what is it that enables an institution to take in stride such series of history-jolting events? Spirit, dedication, preparedness, certainly all of these are important, but the underlying factor is people. And as a person who was there and who received that memo, did you feel that way? Did you feel that there was a way that, because it seems impossible in reading this, that any group would be able to take something like that in stride?
Well, there were the automatic and the less automatic responses that occurred. The automatic response is, this is a person who's gravely injured. We must attend to this without emotion blocking our efforts and confusing our efforts. That was true with Lee Harvey Oswald as well. In the same measure that so many loved our president at that moment, Oswald was the most hated person in the world. Yet, the care he received at Parkland was first rate. It was very intense and prolonged, and they didn't give up easily at all. So the institution itself, the Parkland Southwestern Medical School complex there, was the first community in the world to be impacted by the death of our president, first to know, the first to see it unfold. So that had a profound effect on everyone, and it is summarized very well in this memorandum that it's the people there who were able to knit together, accustomed as they are to severe trauma and someone's disaster. They had to knit together for a coherent effort at saving the president's life and also saving Governor Conley's life. He was very seriously wounded, and he received extremely excellent care and survived. So it's the way the community, having the shock of this, could pull together and share these feelings of grief and come out of it and still function. It is an interesting story that Jim Carrico, the first doctor to the president, after all of this was over in the afternoon, he went home and he changed his clothes and he came back and he operated on somebody late that afternoon.
Mm.
So he was someone of remarkable poise and quite a tremendous human being, taken too soon from us.
Dr. Alan Childs is the author of the new book, We Were There. It is published by Skyhorse. When you look at all of these recollections from the doctors who were indeed there, what is your takeaway? What are some of the standouts and the recollections that really struck you in putting this together?
Well, the things that I cannot forget are walking outside near the loading dock where the presidential limousine was still there. I cannot forget the extensive blood staining of the back seat, the roses on the floor of the car. And I can't forget standing at that loading dock and watching President Johnson being trundled by four Secret Service men surrounding him in tight ring into a car that they had commandeered from a patient who had brought his wife there for delivery. They took his car and trundled Johnson out to Love Field with that. I can't forget that scene, how extremely ashen he looked, how pale and ashen. But clearly the highest impact of all the sights that day was seeing Jackie Kennedy come out of the emergency room still in her blood-spattered pink suit and get into the hearse with her husband's casket. That was the saddest moment of that day for us.
When you look at the recollections of the doctors who you include in the book, were there any surprises to you of recollections of things that they remember or they said that kind of washed over you at the time?
Well, not so much things that washed over me at the time. One thing that I do recall now that my roommate has reminded me of this, and I think I just denied it in my mind for a long time, is that after the casket and the hearse left, my roommate and I went back over to the medical school, and we found some of our classmates who were actually celebrating. They were already very far-right characters, not many, but a few. So So to the extent that some of us were so terribly aggrieved, there were others who weren't and weren't at all silent about it. None of them wrote me their memories, by the way, to publish in my book.
When you look at it as a document, as a collection of recollections, it's clear, while some of these were taken fresh from the time or testimony, but others are more recent recollections. And those certainly give you an idea of just how, even though it's 50 years ago, and I assume the case is the same for you, that this is very fresh in your mind and something that is impossible to move on or shake. It forever changes you.
I don't need to wonder whether I shall ever forget all of this, because every time I hear Walter Cronkite say what he said, every time I see footage, I tear up. I can't help this. It's an automatic reaction. It's an automatic memory of the intensity of our grief and outrage. And I wonder if some of that outrage that we felt then doesn't fuel some of the broad-ranging interest in conspiracy theories, whether, you know, Hugh Ainsworth says there are 200 conspiracy theories. But I wonder if some of that lingering outrage over the loss of this precious young man doesn't still fuel some of that.
I just, as we close, I do want to talk about one image in the book, and that is from Dr. McClelland. And he is still with us, Dr. Robert McClelland. And you have a picture of him holding the dress shirt that he wore during the resuscitation effort. It is bloodstained and something that he keeps.
Yes. He keeps that, and he keeps the memories and his opinions as to what happened that day, which are different from some of the other doctors. And, you know, he was one of the surgeons right in the room observing everything. And some of his conclusions are different from the Warren Commission, and they're different from some of the other doctors who were in the room.
How so?
He believed that the president was shot from the front. He thought he saw that in the Zapruder film. He thought that the neck wound that they saw on the president was an entry wound from a bullet from the front. Others who were in the room at the time initially thought it was an entry wound as well, only later to change their minds and believe that that was some kind of an exit wound. However, I'm not an expert on that whatsoever, and, you know, don't really have an opinion. I do have an extremely high opinion of Dr. Robert McClelland. And, you know, he's, I think, 84 now. We also have in the book the 82-year-old former chairman of the Department of Medicine who was there then, and also the 92-year-old original chairman of the Department of Medicine of Southwestern Medical School contributed his memories that are just as clear as they were the day after the event. He's still teaching at the medical school as well.
The name of the book is We Were There, Revelations from the Dallas Doctors Who Attended to JFK on November 22nd, 1963. The book is published by Skyhorse. Alan Childs, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Joe. I appreciate your time. Thank you a lot.
Thank you so much. Again, the title of the book is We Were There, published by Skyhorse. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.